I always say that the job of a stock exchange is as convener. Our job is to bring together those who have capital with those who need capital in service of an objective. I think we have a unique habit in the UK of talking ourselves down, and within the ecosystem as well, assuming that the grass is always greener somewhere else. And that frustrates me immensely because I meet remarkable companies. We have raised more capital than and been the only European venue in the top 10 in every year in the last 10 years, and actually have seen growth this year and a level of capital raising that is unsurpassed in any other European venue. But we also need the right mix of risk-taking and risk-bearing investing, which is actually going to drive the growth. And the thing that's really interesting is great British companies that are coming to market, increasing number of EU companies that are choosing London. Because now that we've made the listing rule reforms, if you look at a side-by-side of our proposition versus other European venues, it is much more attractive. We're also seeing Asian companies and Middle Eastern companies, some of whom have made deliberate decisions to pivot their strategy from the US to the UK.
Welcome to Money Maze Curated Podcasts. We created this spin-off channel to highlight a selection of innovative firms in the finance sector and beyond. In 1801, in Sweeting's Alley in the City of London, the London Stock Exchange was formally established, creating a centralised venue for securities trading. In 1872, a technology revolution was occurring. Ticker tape and telephone systems were adopting, speeding up price dissemination. As World War I broke out, the exchange helped finance the war, and during World War II, it remained mostly operational despite the relentless bombings London endured. Regional consolidation took place in the 70s, Big Bang in the 80s, and very soon Pisces, allowing for private businesses to have their shares transacted throughout the year via the exchange, will be rolled out. And still, the London Stock Exchange is the biggest bourse in Europe and the third largest in the world, prompting the question, has the news of the LSE's demise been greatly exaggerated? So to explain and discuss and rebut some of the assertions, whilst highlighting the plans for progress, we're delighted to welcome Dame Julia Hoggett, CEO of the London Stock Exchange, to this curated edition of the Money Maze podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. And what an introduction. I wish I'd written that myself.
Well, it's fantastic to be back here. We've had a couple of great interviews already, one with David, who runs the London Stock Exchange Group. And I'd just like to start with a brief recap of your career journey to understand why it made you particularly well suited for this job.
I think whether I'm well suited for this job is for other people to judge. But I describe my career as about answering exam questions. So I'm actually a sociologist who specialized in sub-Saharan East Africa by training. Went into the city to understand how Malawi operated in the global economy, did emerging market debt capital markets at JP Morgan. Then I moved to cover the multilateral development banks from a debt capital market point of view. And the second exam question was, I've talked the talk for 7 years. Can I walk the walk and actually pull the trigger on raising money myself? So I went to a bank called Debt for an Ireland, ran their funding program, ultimately became the CEO of the Debt for ACS Bank, which is the largest covered bond bank in Ireland, which I was doing during the Lehman crisis, which is not a combination of words and letters I would recommend you put together in the same sentence. And then the next exam question was that BAML approached me and said, we've devoted all this grey matter to bank equity structures, but the thing that actually caused the crisis was bank liquidity structures. We'd like to focus on that. Would you come and run that business? And I thought, well, that's a really, really important exam question. So I went to Bank of America Merrill Lynch and I ran their bank flow funding, cover bonds, money markets, and set up their green bond business. And then I had a call from a headhunter, and he literally said, I found your dream job and you're going to hate me. And that was to go to the FCA, really to develop how we supervise investment banks for conduct after the financial crisis. I thought that's a really good exam question. The FCA then asked me to go and run market oversight. So I was running effectively the SEC functions for the UK during Brexit and during MiFID II. And then there was a moment in the summer of 2020 when Apple was worth more than the FTSE 100 for the first time. As director of market oversight, I sat down and wrote down everything I thought I could try and influence to minimize the chance that happened again. The next afternoon, a headhunter phoned, and literally the first words out of her mouth were, Julia, why haven't you applied for the LSE job? So I knew the exam question, and I've learned to trust that those exam questions manifest at sort of critical moments in time. And that really is, how do we make sure that the UK is the best possible place for great companies to start here, grow here, scale here, and stay here? How do we make sure our capital markets have the best possible assets for our policyholders, our pensioners, our savers to have enough money for life events? And how do we reinforce our role as a global financial center? And on that basis, the question was, could I do that more effectively at the FCA or the LSE? I guess you can see which way I jumped to decide. But I think it requires a career where you understand how markets function. You understand the fundamental technology that we operate. I always say I run a 300-year-old fintech. And you also understand regulation, policymaking as well. And fundamentally, I hope you can also drive strategy to enable the brilliant people who work in this building to do something that is really critical for the nation.
Great. Well, you are part of a really important entity in Microsoft, I think, and 5% of you, as we discovered in our interview with David Schwimmer, CEO of the group, you know, the extraordinary power, reach, influence, and everything from, you know, fixed income, FX, you know, clearing, etc. Let's just stay high level for a minute, which is the world of stock exchanges. Why do they serve as such critical financial infrastructure?
It's a very good question. So I always say that the job of a stock exchange is as convener. Our job is to bring together those who have capital with those who need capital in service of an objective. We are, in essence, a great big network effect. I jokingly say we were Facebook before Facebook was Facebook. It's the ability to enable people to connect, to have the confidence that other people are connecting to know that you've got the rules and the approach that give people the confidence to invest and the ability to transact at pace and at scale. That's what venues do. They create the transparency and they lit liquidity that enables people to have a price reference. And they bring together that ability to bring together a very broad range of investors at relatively low cost and friction in order to enable to raise capital. But they also give investors the confidence that what they're investing in is appropriate because they've got the ongoing disclosure regime, et cetera. So it is the combination of the technology, the network effect, the regulatory oversight, and in essence, the dynamism and provision of capital and evolving rule sets that is what a venue does. Now, we have competition in the UK between four different venues who will compete to be the best lit continuous venue that they can be. And that's entirely as it should be. But fundamentally, lit continuous venues are a vital public good in terms of making sure that we can understand and price the most important risk assets we have in the nation, which is our future, our existing and future companies.
And let's just maybe touch on some of the data points. I think when I said earlier on, London Stock Exchange is the third largest stock exchange in the world. It has one of the highest amount of foreign companies listed here. Yeah. Just gives a sense of some of the important data points that maybe are missed.
Yeah, well, the way I always describe it is we tend to be the second largest equity capital market in the world that's in a free market economy. I mean, we're not the second largest free market economy. So actually the strength we have in the UK, not only in our equity market, but actually you've alluded to this, as a multi-asset global financial centre is remarkable. And it's something that most other countries in the world would die to have and takes years to curate between the combination of the existing ecosystem we have, the investors, the advisory community, the law, the rule of law, the quality of our regulation, the quality of our legislative underpinning for all of this is something that is remarkable for the UK. And the London Stock Exchange sits at the heart of that. And we have a job to curate and drive its growth even further. I think we have a unique habit in the UK of talking ourselves down and within the ecosystem as well, assuming that the grass is always greener somewhere else. And that frustrates me immensely because I meet remarkable companies every single day. That's one of the best parts of my job is meeting founders and existing companies and seeing what they do and the breakthrough stuff that we do it. But we tend to treat dynamics that are global as local and specific to us. And the UK has maintained its strength as the largest single equity capital market in Europe, despite Brexit. Despite the idea that some of that power was going to shift and it was going to move elsewhere, we have raised more capital than and been the only European venue in the top 10 in every year in the last 10 years, and actually have seen growth this year and a level of capital raising that is unsurpassed in any other European venue. The other thing we have in AIM is the best growth market in Europe. 53% of all the growth capital that's been raised in the last decade has been raised on AIM. So we have crown jewels all over the place in our markets that we don't tend to talk about. And I think that's one of the things that we sort of need to address as a nation, which is we don't think about that context when we talk about the UK.
And one of the things that frustrates me, because you only need to pick up the paper, is the absence of, you know, listings in the UK. And yet we had Michael Mauboussin from Columbia Business School, on the show last year, and he talked, and I'm going to get it slightly wrong, but 20 years ago, there were over 8,000 listed companies in the US, and today the number might be 5,000. Yeah. There's been a reduction listed companies globally. Yeah. Just what has been driving that?
So there's been a fundamental shift in the way kind of companies progress. And I think we have to recognize that. And one of the things that I'm not a buyer of as a general strategy is this is how we've always done it. You know, I am a massive buyer of saying, what is our purpose? What is our role? And how do we need to evolve the way we execute that purpose in order to meet the world as it is today? And the simple reality is that sort of 20, 30 years ago, companies essentially had bank finance and corporate finance, and then a route into the public markets as their, what you might describe as your the funding continuum. In the meantime, we've seen an enormous growth of private equity and venture capital, actually coming out of the value and the value that was generated by fast-growing companies already being built, and then that value redounding to certain individuals and certain funds. There were a number of people who I think said that VC and PE world is a function of interest rates. It's not going to survive. It's not going to be the thing that actually drives the economy. Well, I'm going to call rubbish on that one.
Yep.
Because actually it's shown itself to work very effectively and to be valuable for companies. Yep. Let's be very clear. Actually, if you've got high quality VC or PE experience on your cap table as a founder, and they're coaching you and saying, look, we've seen these models, this is where the pitfalls and pratfalls are, this is what we think you can do, then that is a really valuable form of business building. And actually what we should care about as the exchange is that we've got a funding continuum of consequential businesses being created that ultimately choose to use the public markets at a certain point in their evolution. But we have to recognize that companies were going public later and later in their evolution, if at all, because there was a compelling proposition, which was the private markets.
Right.
Therefore, you have to make the public markets an equally compelling proposition. You can't be, I know King Canute wasn't actually trying to hold the water back, he was trying to demonstrate the opposite, so I'm probably in his camp, but you can't be sort of Canute-ish about it and say, I don't want it to be so, and therefore it's not going to be so. It is. And if you talk to founders, a vibrant private market is incredibly valuable to them. But what we should have is an appropriate mechanism of transitioning between the private and public markets.
Right.
We shouldn't have these dirty, like, great cliff edges between the two. And we shouldn't make it hard for founders to navigate the journey through the financing that they need to execute against the ideas that they've had. We should make it as straightforward as possible for people to create value, because that's what creates jobs, it creates innovation, it solves problems that society have. That's ultimately creating the investable assets that mean our pensioners can have a decent life, we can afford to pay for the NHS, and we can afford to pay for our defence. And it's all part of a continuum where we have to recognise that these two things fit together. That proposition has evolved over the last 20, 30 years. Actually, the UK shifted later than the US and Europe in terms of the total market cap that was held privately versus publicly. And I wonder whether that's why we're having the debate now in the UK, when in essence, that ship already sailed in the US and in Europe well before it sailed right. in the UK, which is actually a demonstration of the strength of our public markets.
Right.
So I think the reality is we need to have a world where we can have the best of both. Okay. We can enable companies to grow in the private world, but also enable them then to thrive in the public world when they get to a certain scale.
Well, there are three or four really key things in what you just said, and I'm going to come to all of them. But all that glitters isn't gold, and there has been this assumption when you read the papers again that, you know, companies want to relist in the or move their listing to the US because of higher valuations. I think there are 20 British companies that give or take that you know that might have risen, but their journey hasn't been altogether successful. Just touch on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting fact because we've had 20 companies from the UK that have gone to the US in the last since 2014 that have raised over 100 million. So that's a reasonable rubric. Of those 20, 10 have already delisted, and 7 are trading below their IPO price by 77% on average, and only 3 are trading up. So the idea that the grass is always greener somewhere else is not true. And one of the challenges is that if you're a UK company that doesn't then get into an index in the US, and it isn't the same straight through process that is in the UK to know whether you will or not, then you run the risk if something happens when you've got a predominantly domestic investor base in the US, they sell on a headline, and then there's no mechanism of recovering the value thereafter. Now, I understand why companies are advised to do it, the financial incentives for the ecosystem to create that transaction. I do understand that. And it doesn't mean that the UK doesn't have to make sure that we have the most compelling proposition that we have and that we're driving more domestic risk capital into our own markets. But fundamentally, I think we now have a much greater realization that there's pros and cons to the US market as well, and that it's not inevitable that it's an unalloyed good thing when companies go. It's also a very expensive thing. The other final piece is the US listing indexation rules essentially require a company to have substantially their business in the US or to move to the US in order to be eligible for the index. We don't require that of companies who come to London. And that is actually one of the reasons why we have as many international companies as we do listed on our venue. But a founder's got to really decide if the UK gave them the ecosystem to start here and they want to stay here, how do they keep that locus and ability? And the UK as a country has to decide that we care about that and we want to make sure that that's the case. So the grass is not always greener.
So as we assemble this jigsaw, the other is the demand component, mm-hmm. both institutional and mm-hmm. individual.
Yep.
And there's been some, you know, there's been some behavioural changes. Some might be dated all the way back to Gordon Brown, his taxation changes on, you know, on dividends. But we've also
dates even further back than that. Actually.
Okay, and some risk aversion that mm-hmm. we will come to. But just maybe diagnose the institutional and individual challenges.
Yeah. So I think, look, I would take it back to the Mirror pension scandal, yes. ironically. So when we saw the rating of the Mirror pension scheme, then the policy response was to bring defined benefit corporate schemes on balance sheet of the companies, and then to apply an accounting treatment that meant the matching adjustment went through the P&L. So you and I both remember when we used to refer to British Airways as a small airline with a large pension fund attached. Now, you know as well as I do, no CEO wants to be accountable to the markets and to the media every quarter for the volatility of their pension fund rather than the underlying performance of their business. So we shuttered a lot of our corporate defined benefit pension schemes. And then we changed the investing profile of those schemes to de-risk them and to minimize that volatility in earnings. Now, the simple reality is defined benefit pension schemes are the best mechanism of countries taking long-term open mutualized risk-taking in order to deploy risk capital. That's how it's treated in Canada, Australia. That's what the endowments in the US do. That's what an awful lot of other pension funds do. We made a deliberate policy decision to shutter that. Now, I don't think we did it on purpose, but that is the consequence of what happened. We made deliberate policy decisions that caused it to be shuttered. We then removed the incentive to invest in the UK because the dividend tax credit was taken away. Now, I understand that. And also, I'm not convinced going back to a dividend tax credit is a good idea, because actually nowadays, a lot of very fast growing value creative companies don't pay dividends much at all and haven't needed to. And the idea that we only really want to reward dividend hog companies, it may not be the right thing for the nation based on how we create value nowadays. But that compounded it. So we then replaced our defined benefit pension schemes with defined contribution schemes. There were never intended to be 23 or 27,000 of them, but we also then regulated them on cost. So they were supposed to invest in the cheapest thing, and we didn't regulate them on net return. That reduced the amount of active investing. It increased the amount of indexation investing that was done. And then there was this inexorable pull to basically invest in the MSCI rather than in domestic UK indices or even a more balanced index. Consequence is that the UK is now doing more to subsidize cost of capital of companies in the S&P 500 than it is to support the cost of capital of companies in the UK. And that is a series of kind of policy steps, all well-intentioned. But when you take a step back and look at the totality of what happened, it had that consequence. From a retail perspective, we also have made it harder and harder for retail to access regulated markets. Some of that's a function of European regulation, actually. Europe had a rule that said if you were a listed company and you were raising secondary capital, so you needed more follow-on capital, and you didn't do it with a prospectus, you could only sell 8 million shares to retail, whatever the size. If you take a step back and think about that, that was a regulatory decision to forcibly dilute retail against their will, you know, under the guise of protecting them. Now, the UK, to its utter credit, the FCA is making changes to its rules right now to remove that constraint. In addition to that, it created rules that meant that you could not sell fixed income products, so plain vanilla bonds, to retail unless you had an extra prospectus. The cost of producing that prospectus was so great that companies wanted to charge extra for their credit in order to do so. And therefore, retail either had no access to fixed income products or the products that they had were more heavily structured, less liquid and more expensive. Again, that wasn't producing a better outcome for retail either. What the FCA is doing there is also making radical change to our fixed income rules to enable investors to buy those products. But we've effectively made it harder and harder to buy regulated assets and easier to buy unregulated assets. And therefore, the balance of investing in the nation has shifted. And I think this is one of the things that I'm increasingly thinking about as to how we tell the story here, which is a nation needs to have the appropriate amount of its investing that are stores of capital, or stores of value, cash, actually for certain generations in this country, housing, But we also need the right mix of risk-taking and risk-bearing investing, which is actually going to drive the growth and the companies and the employers of the future that mean that we can create real wage increases and improve living standards for the nation and ultimately produce the tax revenue that pays for the NHS and our defence. And we've actually had a miscalibration of that ratio. So we had much more incentive to invest in property and cash and much less incentive to invest in the assets that would actually drive growth in the country. Now, I think that's increasingly understood. There's an increasing amount of regulatory change that is working in that direction. But it's also a psychological thing. It's a cultural thing of how do we recognize that we need to pull these levers and re-incentivize domestic risk-taking in the country for the first time in probably a generation. Yep. The irony is we've done all this to ourselves as a nation, yep. So we can undo it.
Yep.
And the levers are not actually about more tax breaks. They're actually about asking for more as a nation for the tax breaks that we already write. You know, it's not actually as complicated as people think, I think. So we have the second largest capital market in a free market economy. We create more unicorns than anywhere outside the US and China and occasionally India. It depends on the year. We have more consequential research coming out of our universities than anywhere else. We've got second or third largest pool of investable assets in the world and a world leading capital market by any measure. Most countries would die for the raw materials that we have.
Yep.
It's a bit like the bake-off tent. It's actually, you've got all the right ingredients, got the cameras, got the action, got the lights, got the equipment. We actually just need to start baking the cake in the right order. And that's the thing I feel endlessly positive about for the UK. There is a huge amount we can do to build on what is already a phenomenal foundation.
And I think, if I have the data points right, we have the lowest allocation to domestic equities of any developed country in the world.
In our pension funds, yes.
And the only country in the world that gives a tax break for cash products, the ISA, which seems to me absolutely absurd.
Yep.
Would you expect change ahead that is going to be meaningfully helpful? And I'll add to that, you were referring, I think, sort of, you know, to the Tell Sid campaign, mm-hmm. which was back when British Gas, I think, was where's the Tell Sid, Tell Sally today?
Yeah. Well, let me cover two things separately. So on the pension fund side, solving the pension incentive to invest in the UK through tax is not straightforward because we don't actually tax pension funds. And now that we don't have dividend tax credits, we don't have that lever either. We tax individuals. But I think there is a philosophical point, which is if we write 48, 49 billion of pension tax credits a year and ask for nothing as a nation in return for that foregone revenue, that's an unusual choice as a nation. It's not a choice that most nations would make. And a lot of countries look at us sideways for the fact that we seem to have the sense that it's not the done thing. So if philosophically you think that we should ask for something in return for that foregone tax revenue, then how do we achieve that something through some other route? And one of the most obvious ways of looking at it would actually be to say that most people are in the default scheme in their pension fund. In order to be classified as a default scheme, you need to have a certain amount of your assets, whether that's cash, fixed income, equity, property, alternatives, whatever, in the UK in order to justify. Now, an individual could then say, I don't want to be in the default fund. I want to be in something that's 100% maxed out to owning Tesla, let's say. Have at it. You know, you still get your tax rate, still get, but actually most people would say, and the polling that we've seen done by William Wright at New Financial is that the vast majority of the pensioners who we polled, A, thought that 10 times more money of their money was in UK equities than actually was, and 72% wanted that money to be invested in the UK. And so we're not actually fulfilling that kind of compact at the moment between the pensioner. I think most pensioners in the UK think their pension money is being invested in the future of their kids. It's not. And therefore, I think there are mechanisms and tools that could be used quite straightforwardly. On the ISA side, it is more complicated. At CMIT, we've been thinking about it as what I describe as a three-legged stool, which is you need access to regulated products, which is what I talked about before. You need to make sure that from a regulatory point of view, it's actually straightforward for retail to be able to buy equities and fixed income and the stuff that actually gives them more protections than they get in the crypto market, for example. You also need access to advice. You know, if these regulated products can only be sold with advice, you need to be able to have advice. And we've created, as a consequence of rules that were made after the financial crisis, it harder and harder to get access to advice. And we used to have IFAs on every high street. Now we don't, you know. And therefore, what the FCA is doing right now with the Advice Guidance Boundary Review and Simplified Advice is to try and reverse that trend of actually disenfranchising access to advice for UK retail. Then you need to create the financial literacy campaign. There is no point in teaching it in a vacuum where you can't access the products and you can't access the advice. So the deliberate reason why we've been talking about doing a sort of TELSID 2.0, we're really calling it a Hearts and Minds campaign because it isn't connected with an individual privatization. Yes. The idea is to say, how do we come together as the government, the FCA, the Money Advice and Pension Service, all the major banks, the major platforms, and the asset managers who face retail, and say, what are those messages that we actually, for their own sake, need retail to understand? Such as, if you keep all your money in cash, in 5 years' time, you won't have the same buying power as you do today, because there's a thing called inflation. You know, actually, if you're a 23-year-old starting to save into your pension, your risk appetite should be 8 or 9 out of 10, not 2. Yes. You know, the simple stuff that we have not articulated to the population. But then those messages are identified. The FCA says, yes, we're comfortable that those messages can go out there. But then each individual platform then uses those messages under their own branding to target their own client base to compete for, to continue to have very heavy competition for financial services provision to retail in the UK. But fundamentally, raising the bar of that zeitgeistian set of messages that retail are then receiving. So there's a reason it's being deliberately done in this way. And I think I agree with you about cash ISAs, but I think we've treated the idea that we're using ISAs purely as a tool to incentivize saving, when in fact they were designed as a tool to incentivize investing.
Right.
You know, and pension or tax credits are incentivizing a combination of saving and deploying risk capital for the benefit of the nation. That's why they exist. We've over-indexed on the first bit and under-indexed on the second bit.
Yep.
I think where we think it would make a great deal of sense is to have a much more simplified ISA regime where you can keep cash and equities in the same pool, move them interchangeably around, but incentivize the investment to be in UK equities. Because we have other perversities. Stamp duty.
Yes.
And I understand the challenges around this. You know, there's lots of decisions to say, just get rid of it. It brings in $4 billion a year, which is the cheapest to deliver tax that the government collects because it's done straight through processing by the venues or by the custodians. So getting rid of it in one fell swoop is very difficult to do. But we also have to recognize what it does. It incentivizes investors, even in the UK, to invest in companies overseas over companies in the UK. It isn't a fat cat tax because the people who pay it are retail and their pension funds. So we tax the little guy to incentivize them not to back the country they live in and the companies they work for, which is perverse. And therefore, one of the opportunities I think the government could look at is how do we remove stamp duty for retail when they're investing for their ISA? You just get rid of the friction. Actually, it would only cost about £85 million for the country to do for the simple reason that you know what the capped amount that you're going to be able to invest is. So it's not got infinite downside for the country, but it does back the little guy to enable them to save to back Britain, which I think is a powerful thing to do. And the other thing is to give a holiday for companies that IPO from paying stamp just to increase the dynamism and the focus and the investor following for those companies. So I think we have, there's various tools that the government could use, and they're not about new tax breaks. Well, aside from that 85 million, none of the rest of it requires new tax breaks. It requires us thinking differently and asking for more from the things that we already write as a nation.
So let's talk about these big reforms. Mm-hmm. And to recap, it is extraordinary because I think it's missed. We are the second largest pension pool in the world, mm-hmm. 27,000 yep. active pension schemes. What is the average size? Is 300 million. So
that's
it's the
problem.
Absolute, we've had lots yep. of the major funds from Australia and Canada yep. on the show. And, you know, it's self-evident that they've achieved, you know, critical mass and better execution, et cetera. There are two things going on, CMIT, which is the mm-hmm. Capital Markets Industry Task Force, which you've alluded to, and then the Mansion House reforms.
Yep.
Let's maybe just talk about those two.
So the Capital Markets Industry Task Force is something that I formed with an amazing group of colleagues, effectively. We've now been going over 3 years. Yep. And the logic was, if you think about the city, it has historically lobbied in vertical silos of the asset managers here and the insurers here and the investment banks here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody's ever put the whole thing together and said, how does the ecosystem work as a whole? And I understand how the lobbying system works and it's an important part of the ecosystem, but actually if it's done in isolation, it doesn't actually have a sense check whether all of those things together work to make the system work as effectively as it could do. The other thing was the private markets were from Mars and the public markets were from Venus. And yet actually to have a proper funding continuum in the UK, you need them to connect together. And in order to create good consensus around how we create policy in the UK, you need to have all the voices around the table at the same time. But all through the lens of what I described is, how do we create the best possible environment in the UK for great companies to start here, grow here, scale here and stay here? And how do we make sure our policyholders, pensioners and our savers have enough money for life events and old age? Getting back to the basic 101 of what a capital market is for. And if you look at what Lord Hill did when he started his listing reforms in 2020, it was brilliant because quite a lot of the ecosystem was saying, nothing to see here, move along, dear, no reforms are necessary. And yet we actually had listing rules that didn't make it easy for the high growth IP-based companies to come to our market. And it didn't give as much strategic flexibility and agency for companies to operate once they were on our market. So it clearly did need to be fixed. Lord Hill created the template for that, that everybody could respond to. And the FCA moved remarkably quickly to make radical reform in its listing rules. And so it was a really good model for how do we create that consensus in the ecosystem to which regulators and government can now respond? Because an unexpected, possibly insofar as there's a dividend Brexit dividend, was actually that we have straight through policymaking in the UK for financial services regulation in a way that we didn't when we were in the single market. So how do we create the consensus that means we can use that agility more effectively? And so I spent 6 months when I first arrived at the LSE. I said, I'm new here. Can I come and ask you some questions? So I sat down with a lot of founders, CEOs, investors, and said, what's working well and what's not working as well as it could do? What can we improve? And so listing rules was one. So how do we support the FCA in their direction of travel? Availability of sell-side research. So how do we undo some of the European regulations that made it harder for banks to provide sell-side research? How do we really tackle the flow of domestic risk capital in the UK, which is where the pension and ISA stuff comes from? How do we make sure that we maintain very high standards of corporate governance, but we do so in a way that is not a checkbox exercise, but is focused on really giving boards the right agency and applying appropriate stewardship? And how do we have a proper conversation about remuneration so that we really do want the best of the best to be here driving value for the UK? And then how do we make sure we have an ecosystem for scaling consequential private companies? Because we had not in the UK been financing these remarkable companies we've been creating, the very pension funds you're talking about have been coming over to the UK and buying UK assets, yep, which they recognised were brilliant, while psychologically in the UK we were going, there's nothing to buy here. As nuts. So really all those things fitted together. And then the glove of the five fingers and the glove of the CMIT agenda is the culture, how we talk about it, how we celebrate entrepreneurship, celebrate success. And so we all sat around the table, developed this agenda, and then have tried to lean in and to support, provide public support or do the empirical analysis or come up with policy proposals to work and support each part of that evolution. So we've seen the largest reform of our listing rules in a generation from the FCA and more to come. We've seen the government produce a report or commission a report that said we need to remove unbundling and get rid of it and go back to how we used to operate. Yep. The FCA then 2 weeks after they changed the listing rules got rid of unbundling. They just removed them, completely reversed the position. We need to have the proper debate about restructuring pensions and ISA investing, which is what we are doing as a nation at the moment. In fact, we've just been talking about it. The FLC has had Richard Moriarty come in as CEO. Rather than the extra bells and whistles that were previously going to be added to the Corporate Governance Code, those were removed, and the guidance as to how to comply with the Corporate Governance Code was also streamlined. And the stewardship code was reformed to go back to how it had used to be, basically prioritising value creation for shareholders and for stakeholders. And we've had the creation of PISIS, the world's first crossover market, and we've had the Mansion House Compact and the courts. So if you do a bit of a mark to market on what's been achieved since CMIT was created 3 and a bit years ago, it's pretty remarkable. And it is all connected together. These are not separate, isolated things. They're part of trying to drive a vision for what is the way we can make our markets work as seamlessly and as well as possible. And sometimes I get criticized saying, why are you talking about private markets all the time when you run a public market? It's like, well, actually the whole lot is connected. If we want a vibrant funding continuum in the UK that means great companies really can have a home and thrive here, we need to solve all of it, not just one piece of it.
Yeah, and I'm going to, so there's two really important legs of this future. The Mansion House of Call. Mm-hmm. So let's just, if you can hit the highlights of what that means.
Yeah. So one of the challenges in all these evolutions that are happening in our pension funds is we were not as a nation investing in the great scaling private companies we were creating. So Ontario Teachers and the Aussie Supras were all coming over here and buying up our companies. Now, what happens then is you do run the risk that when a company gets to a scale where they want to take the next decision as to what they do, the people sitting around the table deciding that are no longer based in the UK or prioritising the UK's interests. So the risk is it's actually harder for founders who run UK-based companies who want to stay here to actually keep their company here, because they may be incentivised to do a trade sale, or they may be incentivised to do an IPO and not necessarily in the UK. So that was sort of the problem statement. And the value creation of those private companies was huge, and UK pensioners were losing out on it. And therefore, Nick Lyons, obviously, I would say, went off to do something more interesting instead as Lord Mayor for a year. But having been around the table and seen it with those conversations, then went off to create the Mansion House Compact, where some of our largest pension funds committed to direct 5% of their assets into private companies. The subsequent Lord Mayor, Alistair King, has then almost doubled down on that, almost literally, to expand that to 10%. It's now covering, I think, 97% of the defined benefit schemes. Defined benefit contribution. And then focus on other forms of asset as well. But actually really focused on how do we make sure the UK is getting the best returns for its pensioners and backing the great value creators that we have as a nation. And a lot of the reason we hadn't been is because we were regulating on cost. Yes. You know, it's this weird perversity. And I understand why. And I do wonder whether having a competition objective means that you measure on cost rather than on longer term deliverables, because it's easier to measure. But fundamentally, we've got into this perversity of saying in financial services, some of the most important decisions that people make in their life, the cheapest is the best.
Yep.
And what is shown in Canada and Australia is they actually do pay higher fees, but they make much higher returns on a net basis, because they're investing in a much more diversified range of assets. But they do it also by being bigger.
Yep.
When you have 27,000 different pension schemes, all with too small an amount, then the cost of running those schemes is much higher. And actually, that doesn't produce better outcomes for the pensioners. But you also can't wrap it in as much sophistication by definition. And that's what they've done in Australia and Canada. And that's a lot of the drive to consolidate the pension schemes in the UK, to produce the best outcomes for pensioners, but also to produce that level of investing sophistication that means that we can actually see and realise the value that exists in the economy.
Yeah. And we just interviewed Alistair King. It was fascinating to be able to hear that, which brings us to that, back to that earlier point, which is a really significant and I think relatively quick development, which is Pisces.
Yes. Yes.
So let's just, again, if I can ask you just to hit the absolute, you know, this is potentially transformational for inbound capital as well as domestic capital. Yeah. So help our listeners understand.
Let me explain what it is. So Pisces stands for the Private Intermittent Securities and Capital Exchange System Regulation, where the R is silent. and effectively, it's the world's first regulated crossover market between the private and public markets. It enables a private company to stay private, to say, I want to have an auction of my secondary shares at a periodicity of my choosing, so once a quarter, once every 6 months, once a year. They do so on a regulated venue. They do so not charging stamp and also with benefits from the EMI schemes and the share ownership schemes that exist. But what it does is it enables angel and seed investors to have a transparent price formation process when they want to get out, so they can get back to being angel and seed investors and not have their money locked up in a company that hasn't had a liquidity event. It can enable those very pension funds that we just talked about who want to buy private companies to use their existing pipes and plumbing to buy private companies. And also when they have co-investment rights and if they invest in funds to top up their exposure to certain companies that they like. It enables companies to scroll through the VCs and the PEs. If the next ticket that you need as a private company to be written is not one that can be written by your existing cap table, then you can use this as a mechanism of moving through the gears. And crucially, provides liquidity for staff. Because this is a sophisticated investor market, but you're deemed sophisticated to sell your shares by dint of being an employee. So in the war for talent and a retention mechanism for companies that want to use this, really vital way of companies keeping their staff and incentivizing it. And everything I've been trying to do on the exchange, and it's partly because I was an issuer, is about this idea that I describe as issuer agency. How do we give the companies on our market the most agency to execute against their strategy? You know, how do we make it as straightforward as possible for them to do so? And if a company is being forced to take certain actions because of the liquidity demands of the people who are sitting on their cap table, rather than because it's the right thing that they want to do at that time, then actually that doesn't necessarily help the long-term growth and the patient capital growth of the companies. If you look at the 4 trillion companies, the kind of 2 to 4 trillion value companies we have in the world today, they've all had a huge amount of patient capital over the time that has enabled them to realize, pivot, twist, change, adapt their strategy to get to the value creation that they've got to today. And so Pisces was trying to say, how do we think about each one of those challenges that a private company has and use the unique ability of a multilateral venue and the regulation that the UK can produce to really try and solve that problem and to make it as straightforward as possible to transact and to create genuinely a funding continuum in the UK between being private and being public. And in theory, it's also something where if a company wanted to go private, they could also go back down onto Pisces rather than leave the ecosystem altogether. And therefore, you've got the opportunity to use it in multiple different ways. This is genuinely groundbreaking. No other country in the world has done it. The government passed the legislation to do it in June. The FCA produced their rules in July, and they gave us permission to operate a venue in August. Now, I know sometimes we criticize things for being slow, but this is actually an illustration of when the UK has a consensus about the direction travel it wants to take and a consensus around the vision for how to do so, it's now got a capacity to execute at speed. And I really do credit both Treasury and the FCA for all the work they did to make that happen. But it is genuinely groundbreaking. We should be very proud of the fact that as a nation, this is the way we're thinking.
So two things that I want to ask in relation to that is, when do you expect the first transaction? And secondly, might this also be a magnet for non-UK domicile companies to find that this facilitates what they want to do?
So to answer your first question, your second question first, this has been made deliberately available to companies all over the world. So, and we are finding interest from companies all over the world because it is genuinely solving for a problem that they all face. And the more founders I talk to, particularly more VCs and PEs, the more different use cases we're finding. In terms of the first company, the honest answer is I can't tell you that yet. Even if I could, I couldn't. But I think I'll explain the way we're thinking about it. We are rapidly building the registered auction agents, which is the intermediaries who will provide the direct interaction with their end sophisticated clients. That pipeline is building very rapidly. We're building a very rapid pipeline of direct aggregators of sophisticated investors who want to connect directly into the system. And the pipeline of companies that want to use it is building very rapidly. But those companies need to do several things that they haven't had to do before. They actually need to re-examine their articles of association and all of their shareholdership agreements because none of them were written recognizing that Pisces existed.
Right.
And they often have to repaper some of their schemes in order to make sure that they make the tax affairs as efficient as possible. And so the process for how companies are doing that is something that they're setting in train, but does take some time. And I'm not going to be the one who dictates terms to them as to how quickly they need to do that. I said at the beginning, I run a 300-year-old fintech. Our job as a venue is to provide the infrastructure through which these flows can happen. We're not doing this because it's a good thing to do today. We're doing this because it's a good thing to do today, tomorrow, and for the next 30, 40, 50, 100 years. And therefore, it has to work, and people have to be properly prepared to use the market. And therefore, I'm much more focused on, are the companies really engaging? Are they doing the right preparation? Are they finding the right, curating the right offers? In other words, the right shareholders who actually want to sell? And are they engaging with the right investors who want to buy so that when they come to the market and use it, they produce the best possible outcome for themselves? That's really what I'm most focused on. And there is a very large pipeline of companies that are building up and starting to prepare and look at the different use cases that they're exploring. And it's for them to make that preparation in their own time, in the same way it is for an IPO.
Yeah.
It's no different, actually.
Yeah.
I understand the when, but I think you'll see a range of announcements that come from us over the coming months that illustrate the huge momentum that's building in the market.
And we had a live experience. We interviewed a company called Organox up in Oxford Spinout, mm-hmm. FDA approval for liver transplantation, mm-hmm. and they'd just been bought by a Japanese company, and it could have been otherwise, even if the shareholders are, you know, very happy.
Yep.
The question that I didn't ask that I also want to ask in relation to that is, despite the narrative of the drought of IPOs, when you look at the runway, how do you feel?
The pipeline's very busy. We've got some that are announced. We've got a very large number that are preparing at the moment. And the thing that's really interesting is great British companies that are coming to market, increasing number of EU companies that are choosing London, because now that we've made the listing rule reforms, if you look at a side-by-side of our proposition versus other European venues, it is much more attractive. And we are bigger than any other European venue by any measure. And therefore, actually, that attractiveness is becoming really valuable. And we should call out here that FTSE have also made changes to their indexation rules that mean that you can fast track into the FTSE if you have a billion available securities, and you're going to hit the FTSE 225 or above. So that enables the, this is another illustration of taking a step back and going, okay, there's all this passive money that has to buy you. Why don't we make that valuable for the company at IPO? And so we've done that. The other, well, FTSE have done that. The other thing they've done is make it possible for shares denominated in euros and dollars as well as sterling to be eligible for the FTSE. So we actually had our first euro entry, euro-denominated entry into the FTSE last week. And therefore, there's all of these things that are making us a much more compelling proposition. We're also seeing Asian companies. And Middle Eastern companies, some of whom have made deliberate decisions to pivot their strategy from the US to the UK. And I think people realizing that they don't really want a unipolar world, and that the UK is the absolute best alternative in that context. So the pipeline is building rapidly. I think we have to recognize that geopolitical and economic events over the course of the last 6 months left people somewhat on the sidelines, watching and waiting to see how things were going to play out. I think the observation I have is when I talk to people now, people realize that there's a level of uncertainty and movement that is a feature, not a bug, at the moment, as it were. And therefore, sitting and waiting is not any longer the thing that people can do. And so it's also about just how you navigate that feature, rather than say that you're not going to act, which is, I think, why we're starting to see the pipeline build quite rapidly. And we're starting to see things come. And we had Metlen come from Greece. That was a remarkable, actually, event where one of the largest companies in Greece has chosen that they want for the next generation of their growth and globalization to come to London. So effectively, they reincorporated as a PLC here, became eligible for the FTSE, and got in double quick time. And standing on that balcony in our venue with the chairman, whilst he watched the share price go over 50 euros for the first time ever, was an emotional moment.
Yeah.
As an illustration of what London can deliver for international companies as much as what it can deliver for domestic companies.
So for people of a certain age, they might remember Ian during the Blockheads. It reminds me of reasons to be cheerful.
Yes.
So, Julia, how do I sum up here? I mean, I am excited, and I think a number of us, you know, in this whole ecosystem, we've been observing, having conversations, and it's so easy to be critical, and there is much to worry about and wonder about at all sorts of levels, but there is some real action that is taking place. I like the fact that you describe London Stock Exchange as the second biggest capital market in the free world, and we do forget that, a 300-year-old fintech. But you are also pointing at something which is one of the greatest investment risks, is not taking risk. Mm-hmm. And there has been a cultural shift in this country that is explained by lots of things, but must reverse. There has been this need to bring together these pension funds and to make them more efficient and give mm-hmm. them buying power and give them optionality and to deploy it into all of this growth capital. I mean, we've had interviews with the Oxford and Cambridge, you know, ecosystems and the spin outs. And in fact, we've got one of our sessions at the Money Maze Allocator Summit coming up, which is being hosted at the London is the Great British Opportunity. Yeah. And we will have, you know, those very people overseeing portfolios investing, talking about why this is so exciting. So I think your Hearts and Minds campaign is absolutely right. I think you made a point, which is often lost, is that if you are in your 20s, your risk appetite should be 8 or 9 out of 10. Mm. It certainly shouldn't be in a cash ISA. So between the Mansion House Accord, CIMIT, Pisces, there's a lot of good stuff going on, and I know you've mentioned many more. And so well done, and keep going, because your country needs you.
I was going to say, I always say that keep calm and carry on is not just a mug in the UK, it's a way of life. But look, you mentioned the optimism, and I am relentlessly positive, possibly as a human being. But I look at the raw ingredients we have. I look at the strength we have as an exchange. I look at the strength we have as an economy. We haven't necessarily got all the ingredients in the right order. The risk-taking piece is the most important bit. We have created a culture where we so protect people from the downside that we don't expose them to the upside. We need to have that conversation as a nation. But we are still the second largest market in the world, despite that. Think what we can be if we actually took the handbrake off ourselves and unshackled even more of the capacity we have as a nation to invest and to grow. And that's the reason. And I don't think this is about tax breaks. I think this is about almost a psychological shift that as a country, we want to take steps to back ourselves and use our own resources to do so and encourage others to continue to use London as a really important vehicle for financing their ambitions as well. But we shouldn't shackle our own ambitions as a nation. And stop talking ourselves down and being constantly referential to others and recognise that we have unique strengths that we should really play to.
Great to be here at the London Stock Exchange today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
All content on the Money Maze curated podcast are for your general information and use only, and it's not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is accurate at the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the contents. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed. Additionally, please note that the Money Maze curated podcasts are funded by the interviewee or their featured organization, unlike the Money Maze podcast, which is funded by third-party advertising.